You're listening to The Monocle Daily, first broadcast on the 22nd of January 2024 on Monocle Radio.
The foreign ministers of the EU join forces to encourage calm in the Middle East. The hopeful beginnings of a vaccine programme which could transform Africa. And when is it better for a president to stay home than to be seen using the official transport? I'm Andrew Muller. The Monocle Daily starts now. Hello and welcome to The Monocle Daily, coming to you from our studios here at Midori House in London. I'm Andrew Muller. My guests, Daniela Peled and Oscar Juadiola-Rivera, will discuss the day's big stories. We'll have the latest from New Hampshire on primary eve, and we will distill the deliberations of Davos on the subject of artificial intelligence. Stay tuned, all that and more coming up right here on The Monocle Daily. This is The Monocle Daily. I'm Andrew Muller, and I am joined today by the Managing Editor of the Institute for War and Peace Reporting, Daniela Peled, and by Oscar Juadiola-Rivera, who is a Professor in International Law and International Affairs at Birkbeck College. Hello to you both. Welcome back. Happy New Year and so on.
Hello.
Happy New Year to you all.
Oscar, it is traditional when you are on the show to begin the show by discussing what in the wide world of sports you are wearing today. Unfortunately, you haven't been able to bring the star accoutrement into the studio today.
I was wearing my Michelin Man huge red absolutely cozy jacket, which sounds like a storm, so I couldn't bring it in here.
It does rather rustle, but yes, listeners, Oscar does have an enormous red jacket. From where does one source such a garment? It looks like an AI fake.
You're going to laugh. From the very warm island of Gran Canaria.
How big a market can there possibly be in Gran Canaria for enormous warm puffy coats?
It's incredibly paradoxical. I guess this is the way Canarians feel really European in winter. So they tend to buy these really wintry garments. I mean, it's like 20 outside, but you will see them wearing scarves and gloves and so on.
It's like the opposite of Newcastle.
It's really, really.
I think it's important to also note that the Oscar is wearing a very fetching tomato orange polo neck with contrast stitching?
Yes, yeah. And the spiky shoes.
Fetching is the word I would use for it. But Daniela, you interrupted somewhat what was going to be a seamless link, because I was about to say, whereas you have recently been somewhere that an enormous cosy red puffer jacket would have come in handy.
Oh dear, I ruined it.
You did.
Indeed. I apologise fulsomely. I was in Iceland. It was icy.
It is, hence the name.
Yes, exactly. All those things are true. It's cold. The people are wonderful. It's expensive and it's very, very rich in local history. I was extremely happy.
Regular listeners will be aware, Daniela, that local history is pretty much your favourite thing on earth. Was there one particular local history museum in Iceland that especially beguiled you?
Oh, gosh. There was one wonderful one with lots of cottages transplanted from the regions of Iceland into one big kind of park, which was empty and deserted and spooky and just glorious.
Well, on that fulsome recommendation, we will hear more from Daniela and Oscar later in the show, but we will start in the United States, which is a day away from the New Hampshire presidential primaries. The Democratic one is a more or less total non-event, as the Democratic National Committee has not sanctioned it, preferring to launch the party's primaries in South Carolina on February 3rd. And the Republican one will be less of an event than it might have been following the withdrawal from the race of Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. As it now stands, the only serious rival to former President Donald Trump for the GOP nomination is former South Carolina Governor and U.S. Ambassador to the UN, Nikki Haley. Well, I'm joined with more on this by the reporter H.J. Mai. H.J., New Hampshire on primary eve, what is it like? Is it agog with excitement?
Yeah, to be honest, first of all, thanks for having me. It's not that much excitement here. I talked to a lot of people. It's definitely a different atmosphere. You mentioned, especially after Ron DeSantis dropped out yesterday. It's definitely a different atmosphere than it was 4 years ago, or even 8 years ago, when the former president, won New Hampshire and really launched his political run toward the presidency. It's cold here. There's a lot of snow, but it seems like, the former president might wrap up this a primary really tomorrow evening already. At least those are all the indications.
So does DeSantis bailing out make any particular difference to anything, checking out as he did with a bogus Churchill quote? Or is the fact that it didn't make any difference to anything the reason he's quit?
Yeah, I think it's the latter. I think, you know, him bowing out, I mean, he modeled himself after the former president as like a Trump light. You know, he entered this race as the anti-woke candidate, focusing on culture war issues, you know, trans issues in school, gender issues. And I think, you know, most of his supporters just never really wanted a Trump light. They wanted the real thing. So I don't think it will make a huge difference. His ground game in New Hampshire was really not existent. He has focused very much the last week or so on South Carolina, but polls even there indicated that he was just in the single digit range, and so I think, you know, everybody saw the writing on the wall, and him dropping out shouldn't really make a difference for tomorrow's primary here in New Hampshire.
Well, that does leave Nikki Haley, of course, who has positioned herself very much as a non-Trump candidate as opposed to Trump light. She wants to be the Republican Party's sensible alternative. Nobody thinks she has a prayer of winning this primary, but what kind of result does she need to make it look like she might still be a contender?
I think for her to, you know, keep this train moving forward and going to South Carolina, to her home state, I think she would either really have to be within, like, you know, several percentage points of Donald Trump tomorrow, or even win New Hampshire. I think, as you mentioned, you know, the indications, it's unlikely to happen that she has a chance to win here. But she has to have a really good result. Or I think, you know, if that doesn't come true, you know, her money will dry up, the donors will turn away, and I think everybody will realize that we're looking once again at a rematch of 2020 between the former President Trump and current President Biden.
Just a final thought, though. Would it not be weird and self-defeating for every candidate just to leave the field to Trump? Because, well, what are we? January. 10 months is a long time in politics, especially when you're facing 91 felony charges. Doesn't it make sense for someone to try and stay in the race just in case Trump is not available come November?
You know, for somebody who has been covering this, I think it should make sense, but I haven't heard that, to be honest. You know, talking to the different campaigns, I think, you know, everybody has resigned to the fact that he will be, you know, once again, the nominee for the Republican Party. And I think nobody really believes that those indictments that you mentioned, you know, the 91 criminal indictments that he's facing will actually, you know, be an issue when it comes to November. I think, you know, what everybody was counting on, and especially Nikki Haley, is that people realize, independent voters, you know, moderate Democrats who might not be happy with the Biden administration, they would be much more likely to vote for somebody like a Nikki Haley than a Donald Trump. But that is not the message, clearly, that resonates with Republican base voters, whether it was in Iowa last week or here in New Hampshire this week.
H.J. Mai, thank you for joining us. Let's bring our panel back in, Daniela Pellet and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, and we'll look at the Middle East, much as a conclave of EU foreign ministers have been doing, consulting separately with their Israeli and Palestinian counterparts, respectively Israel Katz and Riyad al-Maliki. Foreign ministers from Jordan, Egypt and Saudi Arabia have also joined the confab in Brussels. EU foreign policy honcho Josep Borrell has insistently reiterated the conventional wisdom that a two-state solution is the way forward, an obvious rebuke to Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent dismissals of the idea. Daniela, first of all, Israel Katz, who has been recently installed as foreign minister, having held a variety of similar ministerial positions in the Israeli government, is reported to have floated an old idea of his, which would see an artificial island built in the Mediterranean off the coast of Gaza. Now, to be clear, this is not, as some have interpreted, the idea that they would deport every single Palestinian in Gaza to this. He sees this as a kind of, you know, a shipping port, an opportunity, an economic development possibility. Do you think it's likely to meet with much enthusiasm from EU foreign ministers?
I think the EU is quite used to it's one of its major roles in the Israel-Palestine conflict, which is to pay up, often to pay for things which are then destroyed in subsequent rounds of fighting. I have sat through so many meetings where strange geographical answers to involving artificial islands and actually this bit of Jordan or that bit of Egypt coming into play. It's again just trying to finesse a solution in a kind of very non-solution-y way. Having said that, I mean, no one really expects very much from the Israeli delegation at these talks. I think it's more a question of what the EU can do with its own quite limited influence and powers. It's interesting to have this idea of the two-state solution revived, which until fairly recently, until the current war, was only we would only be accompanied by the words paying lip service to. And I'm not sure it's just because of Netanyahu's intransigence, but I think it is. There is a genuine chance that this is being revived as a possible way forward, however unlikely that seems. But any way forward seems unlikely right now. The EU, of course, can't go in and impose a two-state solution, but it has various tools that it feels that it can leverage. For instance, this idea of sanctions against violent settlers in the West Bank. This is something that's growing and growing in popularity. I mean, this sends all the right signals, annoys the Israelis enough, but not too much. And although the impact would be sort of fairly minimal, this is something that Israel has always taken seriously. And the idea of, boycotting settlement goods, for instance, these are tools that the EU still has in its armoury.
I do want to come back to that slightly counterintuitive resuscitation of the idea of the two-state solution. But, Oscar, considering Foreign Minister Israel Katz's pitch further, aside from the artificial island idea, he was also trying to rouse EU foreign ministers to Israel's side, saying that, we are all, as he put it, in a global battle against radical Islam. Now, despite the fact that quite a lot, a depressing number, in fact, of those EU foreign ministers do represent countries which have been targets of Islamist terrorists, do you expect to find many takers for that line?
No, I don't. And the reason for that is that everybody is now absolutely clear what the project in Palestine is. It has nothing to do with fighting radical Islam. It is a war designed to displace, to dismantle, to destroy what is happening in the West Bank. I was in May last year in the West Bank, and you could see this coming. Of course, Israel has many friends, still has many friends in the West. But it is also becoming clearer and clearer that the opinion is changing. Netanyahu's intransigence is already becoming really problematic for its staunch allies, for the United States and others. And we see what is happening in the United Nations. And for everyone, it's clear that this is not about radical Islam. You couldn't paint the entire Palestinian population with that brush.
The EU, of course, Daniela, may be thinking that out the other side of this, it won't be Benjamin Netanyahu they're having to deal with anyway. But nevertheless, especially given recent events and especially given the events of October 7th, among anybody who might form the next government of Israel, how much enthusiasm is there going to be about a two-state solution?
Well, enthusiasm on both sides, by the way, which you once at one point was fairly consistently even, has dwindled. But there's a marked difference between how people view this in absolutely beleaguered Gaza and how they do in the West Bank. If you're talking about within Israel, again, it's this conceptually there is some support for it. But I think for them, I don't think we can discount the idea of radical Islam as playing a part in this. Certainly, Israel's idea to defeat Hamas completely is unlikely. And what is likely to replace it or exacerbate the situation is likely to be an increased Islamist terrorism, and not just in Israel, but you know, internationally as well. But in terms of the two-state solution from the Israeli point of view, really almost for generations now, we have this idea that the conflict can't be solved. The conflict has to be managed. And this is another area which I disagree with Oscar. I don't think this could be seen coming. I don't think this is the culmination of a fixed strategy. I think it's a classic example of Israel trying to manage the conflict while trying to play demographic games by harassing Palestinians in the West Bank and increasing settlements and just having the occasional round of violence in Gaza. I don't think this was something that was planned. I don't think this is something wished for. And I think this all there's a realization in Israel that although people, the public consensus is this war is necessary, I think there is a realization that ultimately this is very, very, very bad news for Israel's domestic security and international standing.
Well, let's move along to Nicaragua and to the always daunting task of attempting to divine what overstaying President Daniel Ortega thinks he is doing. A little over a week ago, Ortega appeared to assent to a relatively merciful gesture, releasing a prominent Catholic bishop and 18 other clergy who'd been locked up for more than a year on the basis of Ortega's fevered conviction that they and the church in general were part of some hideous plot to orchestrate his defenestration. The freed priest have been delivered to the Vatican. If the pattern of previous such deportations is followed, all will be stripped of their citizenship in due course. Oscar, there's been three more priests removed from post in recent days. Bunches more have been arrested in recent weeks. Is this a new preoccupation of Ortega's, or is this the old school Marxist bee still buzzing in his bonnet?
Well, this is the old school, not even Marxist, because as your listeners will remember, and I'm sure it's very good to disagree, but I'm sure Daniela will agree with me that the arc of Ortega is one of those total paradoxes. You know, he comes to power and makes an enemy of the church, being part of the Sandinista revolution, but then when he returns to power in 2007, he does so in a alliance with the church, in fact, both the Catholic and the Presbyterian churches, in exchange for sustaining socially conservative policies such as banning abortion and so on and so forth. But then when it becomes clear that Ortega is ready to do anything and everything in order to stay power, and he cares not at all about ideology, revolution, or the well-being of anybody, but just staying power.
It's been your basic Animal Farm scenario,
exactly,
hasn't it?
Exactly. So he's ready to continue to persecute anybody whom he feels is a threat to power. And with the Nicaraguan, 40% of the Nicaraguan population is still adhering to the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church has power. And that's what he fears. This is why he's going against him. But this is his old school mannerisms. Not even the other leftist leaders of Latin America agree with him. In fact, he has been strongly criticized by Gustavo Petro of Colombia and others.
Daniela, there are very few, if any, examples from history of being in power that long doing wonders for anybody's mental equilibrium. And we have, well, Ortega, it's important to note, I think, governs in cahoots with his wife, who is also the vice president, which is the sort of thing that happens in completely sane and normal countries
Family business.
He recently accused Miss Universe of being part of some plot against him. This was Miss Nicaragua, who won the Miss Universe pageant recently. Do we have to consider the possibility that President Ortega no longer has two oars in the water?
Well, it seems counterintuitive that you wouldn't recruit the institutions like the establishment church to your own agenda. I mean, these are institutions, usually, you know, you support them financially. There's areas of, you know, of common interest. The Vatican, you know, is careful politically, internationally. But to my mind, actually, it's a fairly clever method of social control. I mean, there are other religious groupings, Christian religious groupings, but, you know, the Catholicism has the largest share. And while people can still go to church, they can still practice, I think there is quite close surveillance on religious life. So, you know, you can be involved in your community, but you will know that the government is watching you. And that sends quite a powerful message to ordinary people who might not even be that politically involved or politically aware.
Oscar, history also has very few examples of paranoid demagogues growing saner in office. So how much weirder could Ortega get? I was reading, and I do commend it to our listeners, a very good piece in El País published yesterday about what life is currently like in Nicaragua for anybody who doesn't agree with Dani Ortega. The piece was written by a necessarily anonymous journalist, but pointing out that give or take the people that Ortega has thrown out of the country, 600,000 people have left.
Well, that tells you exactly how sane he is, and the fact that he's not going to become you know, any saner or even pragmatic. I understand the idea that there is a, you know, throwing the people into this kind of confusion does help control. But at the same time, it is clear in the Americas that what Ortega is doing is simple authoritarianism, and things are not going to get better for as long as he remains there. So, and he has no longer any allies in the region. Idea that he would all of a sudden wake up and try and change is just not going to happen. I remember talking to Nicaraguan activist Bianca Jagger not long ago, and she was painting exactly the kind of scenario that your El País journalist described. Things are becoming weirder in Nicaragua, and will become weirder if Ortega stays.
Just a quick follow-up, Oscar, and you have already partially answered it, but Ortega was regarded, or at least I think enjoyed regarding himself as this sort of grandfather-slash-godfather figure to succeeding generations of leftist Latin American leaders. Does he not have any adherents left? Does nobody, still want his picture on their wall?
Not at all. Not at all. And it's a shame. I mean, the Sandinista revolution was a crucial historical moment for many in the Americas. And we did have at least one interesting album by The Clash.
Interesting is a euphemism. It's a whole other conversation. Myself, I reckon there's about half a decent Clash album secreted among three albums of mostly self indulgent nonsense.
Correct, but that's exactly the kind of light or meaning that he had back then. It has lost all of that. I mean, if even a former guerrilla commander, as Gustavo Petro in Colombia, is ready to tell Ortega, look, you lost him. Then he has.
Well, now to some actually good news, if we can stand it. Earlier this month, by way of fanfare for what we're about to get into, Cape Verde became the first sub-Saharan African country for half a century to be declared malaria-free by the WHO. Today, Cameroon has taken a significant step towards joining it, launching the world's first malaria vaccine program. All children up to the age of 6 months will be offered the vaccine free. This follows pilot programs in Malawi, Ghana, and Kenya, where the vaccine put a 13% dent in deaths from malaria among children of that age group. Daniela, it's important to note that this is not yet a cure for malaria. They reckon the vaccine is maybe effective in about a third of cases. Nevertheless, this could be a really big deal, couldn't it?
As it happens, I spoke today to a friend who works for Action on Malaria UK.
Mm-hmm.
Partly in the expectation to see that the negative side of this story, why this actually was some sort of like terrible idea, it was going to end in disaster. But no, I mean, this is one of those genuinely rare occasions where, you know, a country is being empowered by Global Vaccine Alliance to make a real difference. I mean, Cameroon is the first. There's going to be, I think, 20 other countries to come, a total of 30 interested. And the vaccine is at the start of the process, but there seems to be great hopes of it combined with other prophylactic measures, such as nets and so on. But the fact that we're talking about it, really, and the fact that it's raised headlines is a major is a major bonus. You know, it's malaria is a huge, huge, huge killer, and I don't know how to put this. It doesn't really have the glamour of some other diseases, which, you know, people are very happy to raise money for and campaign over.
Because it is important to note, Oscar, he said, leading the witness, it's not just the fact that malaria kills, I think, around 600,000 people in Africa every year, which is a horrendous human toll in itself. The incalculable knock-on economic effect caused by people being ill who then can't work, people having to look after people who are ill and therefore can't work, you know, people not being able to save or invest because they have to spend money on treatment. If you could liberate the continent of Africa from that, it could be transformative.
It would be wonderful. Indeed, you're absolutely correct. The knock-on effect on, you know, the finances of health services in Africa. All these could change if the vaccine works. As Daniela also suggested, yes, in principle, this vaccine by GlaxoSmithKline seems to be effective in only 30% of cases. But experts expect that a second malaria vaccine, which is being developed by Oxford University and was approved by the World Health Organization in October, might be even an even more practical solution. If that happens, together with the strategy that Daniela described, this could be a game changer for Africa.
Daniela, how important, nevertheless, is the messaging? Because for obvious reasons, we have, and indeed are, living through something of a boom time for vaccine scepticism, perhaps especially in the spoiled wealthy nations of the West, where we've come to take them for granted, to the extent that somewhere around 3.5 million children here in the UK are estimated not to have had a measles vaccination.
It's still an uphill struggle in the developing world, you know, across the board, really. This is about, it's about education, and it's about health, and it's also about trust in governments, and it's also about how you deliver this. You know, in Cameroon, this is being delivered sort of a very much local level, in conjunction with the health services. I don't think that vaccine skepticism is diminishing anywhere in the world, and there are all kinds of actors who are interested in promoting it, because there is this confluence between vaccine skepticism and other nexuses of conspiracy theories.
Well, the rule is that a person who believes one conspiracy theory tends to believe all of them.
Exactly, and this can be very, very useful for all kinds of malign actors. That's malign state actors and malign domestic actors. You know, the malaria is just as fertile a ground for this as any other kind of conspiracy theory.
I mean, Oscar, just a final thought on that. Is there anything we should have learnt from the last few years about vaccine messaging? How do you persuade people that this, no, is not going to infuse you with killer nanobots, which we will activate at some unspecified point in the future?
The one thing I like about the story in Cameroon is that nobody's saying that the vaccine alone will kill you. Mm. And I think that is part of a better messaging. No, this will only work to a certain extent, and only if it is, if it is done together with a set of other measures, which immediately bring to mind the idea of a more reasonable public-wide health service, which requires, prevention first and foremost, the nets and so on and so forth. That seems to me a more reasonable message, but also one that, because it is familiar and resonates with the experience of mothers in Africa, for instance, would be easier to take up.
Well, to the etiquette of availing oneself of such state-funded transport as may be a perk of your office. Probably the general rule is that nobody much minds their nation's leader travelling in a certain degree of style and comfort so long as they are doing the nation's business. The taxpayers of the Philippines seem unconvinced that this applies to summoning the presidential helicopter to get oneself to a concert by dull rock group Coldplay. President Ferdinand Marcos Jr. has countered that there were traffic jams, a line which appears to be doing little to placate the rage of the seething voters who have to sit in them. Oscar, first of all, I would have thought/hoped well, that anybody in President Marcos's position would act with rather more rectitude in this matter. But if your name is President Ferdinand Actual Marcos Jr., and for our younger listeners, he is the son of one of the most atrocious crooks of the 20th century who plundered the Philippines for billions before being chased into exile by a pitchfork-waving mob, I'd be a little more careful about this.
Was he wearing any of his mother's shoes? Really, my trusted source on this is Daniela's little bright boy who put it, absolutely nailed it. He says to me, we were talking about it, he says, well, if you take a helicopter, at least you should take it to hear a nice band. Not Doll Coldplay. So that tells you everything you need to know. Ferdinand Marcos, bad shoes, incredibly terrible taste in music, and uses the helicopter precisely in the metropolitan capital of the world's worst traffic jams. There is nothing to save him.
And with that, Daniela, we inch ever closer to the inevitable day in which you are joined on the show by Adam, your son. but Adam, your son is not wrong, is he? This is just risible all round. There is nothing good about this story, not his choice of music, nor the means by which he chose to go and listen to it.
Well, I mean, I don't know. I think there is a certain constituency that does admire this brash kind of, right, I'm president, I'm just going to take a helicopter and
Exactly.
As Adam pointed out, if it had been Slayer, that might have been cooler. But I think
I don't know if Slayer play at the kind of venues where there's a helipad is the difficulty.
Okay, but we're in the realms of fantasy. Let's go large. But I think sometimes, you know, people, there is a sort of grudging public admiration of this kind of flagrant flexing of muscles. You know, they have the security argument. I need to fly this private thing because there was a security threat to me. But it has to be done with some panache.
See,
was a failure of panache in this case.
I'm not an expert on the Philippines. In fact, I have never so much as been. Would be delighted to go at some point, however. It strikes me, Oscar, that this is one of those things where attitudes vary significantly between countries. Like, genuinely, if I think of this from the point of view of Australia, where I'm from and where I have recently been, this would be career-ending to the extent that I don't think it would even begin to occur to any head of government that, yep, just fire up the official chopper, I've got a concert I want to go and
Absolutely,
see.
Absolutely, particularly if you go to watch Coldplay.
Especially if you go and watch Coldplay.
But dare I say that, for instance, you know, I can think of an emirate or two where taking the helicopter to watch Coldplay would be seen as really cool. So, yes, it does vary.
It's not, for me, it's honestly not the taking of the helicopter I've got a problem with. I mean, it's the destination. I can well see that if I had access to an official helicopter, the temptation just to every so often say, I don't know, can we just go up and do a few laps? I can see myself being susceptible to that.
On that one, I'm absolutely in agreement with you. All the more so because the singer of Coldplay made a point of saying, oh, here we are making an effort to use our electric bands and so on and so forth to come to the concert, even though you have these really bad traffic jams. And contrast that with President Marcos on a helicopter. So actually, on both sides, this is just terrible. Neither Coldplay nor Marcos can be saved.
See, I do want to bring it back finally to the UK, Daniela, where and this is part of my theory that different countries do see this massively differently. And obviously, the President of the United States, both for reasons of security and prestige, travels everywhere in not just his own 747. There is a whole squadron of aircraft that travel with it, these enormous transport planes carrying all the vehicles. I know this because we had to wait for it all to take off when we tried to leave Vilnius in July. Whereas here in the United Kingdom, I don't think people resent so much a lot of the nonsense that the royal family have access to. But people in this country, if you print a picture in a newspaper or on social media of a cabinet minister sitting in a first-class carriage on public railways, people lose their minds.
Absolute outrage. There was much tedious Corbyn era stuff of you know, Jezza sitting in his man of the people, in the train. But I think actually the royal family is a very good example, because if there's ever sort of any wobble about Prince William or Kate or anything, as sure as night follows day, then there will be a photograph of them taking some budget airline to go up to Scotland or to go on holiday with the Kiddiewinks. I mean, this is also
a powerful
message. Yeah, to watch Coldplay. Actually, you know what? That's really plausible.
That's very plausible.
On that prophetic note, Daniela Pellard and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, thank you both. Finally, on tonight's show, since returning from the World Economic Forum, there are two topics of conversation the Monocle Davos team have not yet dropped: Christie's driving and AI. In a desperate bid to drown out one of those subjects, Monocle's studio director has summarised all you need to know about the future and safety of artificial intelligence as heard on the streets of Switzerland.
Attending my first World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos this year, I expected the small skiing town to be abuzz with appearances from heads of state and talks on democracy, sustainability, and security. But walking down the promenade, it quickly became clear there was only one topic tripping off lips into eager ears: artificial intelligence, and, to a lesser extent, blockchains. Standing in one spot, I was surrounded by signs emblazoned with names and phrases like "This is Enterprise AI," "Being AI First," and "Blockchain Central Davos." Behind me stood the newest and busiest of the hubs, the inaugural AI House. Despite it being one of the physically largest venues on the street, getting inside was often a great task. The panels were fully booked a week ahead, and the ground floor bar space was always heaving with people networking or watching presentations. The curator, Hannah Brahma, explained what sets AI House apart from all the other tech hubs.
This is really a technology that's going to impact us all. And making sure that there is enough like representation and that people can kind of interact with a topic that's going to significantly impact and touch their lives. And that's why, for example, like you said, it's hard to get into the ground floor, but that's also because we keep it open to the general public, and that's important to us.
With the words "significantly impact their lives" echoing around my head, I thought of recent headlines extolling the dangers of the technology, the warnings of AI dismantling democracy, sowing lies and division, not to mention outskilling us in almost every industry. But this wasn't some sort of doom and gloom fest. Rather, it was an education of the lesser-known but equally important virtues. I suppose the Luddites of the Industrial Revolution were valid in their concerns over its impact on their lives in the short term, but when you look at the way it changed the broader world, perhaps disorder does always bring progress. Charles Adkins, newly appointed president of Hedera, a digital public ledger platform, explained to me how we are entering into the third revolution of the internet, and how tools like blockchain and tokenization are steering the way.
Web 1 was really kind of publication. You could create a web page, you could write essentially an online newspaper, an online magazine. The second was people could interact with each other. So Web 2 was really kind of that social revolution, mobile revolution, where now you have applications where we can send messages to each other. I can post my own content. And then Web 3 is you can still do the reading, we can communicate, we can write our own content, but now we actually have ownership of that content. Artists, for example, you see this a lot with NFT projects. They'll create artworks and they'll put those on a marketplace. They sell those artworks and then they receive, you know, the value from that. The interesting thing is that with tokenizing that artwork, if that's resold again, you also are still entitled to a royalty of that through the smart contract. So I make the analogy of if Pablo Picasso's family was still earning royalties every time one of his artworks were sold at an auction, they would still be very wealthy. But unfortunately, somebody buys that original artwork, if it's passed to a secondary market, that family never receives any of that benefit ever again.
And while a lot of that might not be relevant to everyone's life, Rasmus Rota, co-founder of Morantix, an AI investment platform, divulged just a few applications they're invested in that will have a positive impact on us all.
One of our companies, Vara, is using AI to detect breast cancer, and it's already running close to 70% of cancer screening in Germany and many other places, and finds much more cancers and much quicker than any doctor, so really has a positive impact because when it's detected early, it's curable.
It certainly sounds enticing, and surely that's what revolutions are all about, ensuring accessibility to the masses, not just the few. As nice as all this sounds, however, we can't just trust that developers are going to always have our best interests at heart. There has to be a legal framework in place. But how do you regulate something that oftentimes isn't tangible and cannot be confined within dotted lines on a map? Kai Zenner, digital policy advisor for the MEP Axel Voss, is part of the team writing the EU AI Act.
This is a problem that the European Union struggles for years with. We have the things that in the mindset of many policymakers in Germany, for example, but also in Brussels, data flows are stopping at the border. Like you indicated, it's not the case. But what the EU is always trying to do is, let's say, to have at least for the internal market, so all 27 member states, a kind of common set of rules. Even though in the digital field, those rules are often more principle-based or a little bit high level, because of also what you said, digital is something fluid, it's something that is changing, especially AI. It's something that can evolve because of different or new input data. They are creating different output and so on and so on.
But Rasmus worries that we may already be going too far with regulation. And it seems that despite being involved in the creation of the EU AI Act, Kai might kind of agree, going as far as to call the work in progress a compliance monster.
Yes, this is indeed one of my major concerns. One of the downsides of the negotiations was that there are a lot of very vague and sometimes also contradictory and overlapping text passages with other legislation and so on. And my fear is that especially smaller market players, SMEs, startups, they will often struggle to have really legal certainty if they want to bring one of their products or services on the market, because there is then maybe Article 10, which is for them completely unclear. It doesn't now apply to me in all instances, what I need to do, etc. pp. If standards are not there, because standards could be the way out of that and could deliver the necessary specifications, then I think a lot of those smaller companies are rather doomed, and they are having the decision, either we are not innovating in AI because it's too risky, or we are buying very expensive certification, third-party auditing from Deloitte, Ernst & Young and all those companies, which of course want to have money for that. And this would then raise the production prices quite a lot, and again, would force probably a lot of market players out of the market, which in the end probably has one big winner, which is US big tech firms. They have the money and everything.
Perhaps the Luddites had a point. After all, the technology that led Britain to the Industrial Revolution has ultimately led to an era of fast fashion and slave labour. But while nobody here has a crystal ball to see how all this will turn out, it seems that everyone is intent on not letting history repeat itself. For Monocle, at the World Economic Forum annual meeting in Davos, I'm Christy O'Grady.
Thank you, Christy. And that is all for this edition of the Monocle Daily. Thanks to our panellists today, Oscar Guardiola-Rivera and Daniela Pellaird. Also to HJ Mai at the top of the show in New Hampshire. Today's show was produced by Tom Webb and researched by Neoma Akwe. Our sound engineer was Tamsin Howard. I'm Andrew Muller here in London. The Daily returns at the same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.